History is what we make of it and what we live every day. We are all feeling pain. You cannot deny it. But the response to pain is something separate from the pain itself. And in that distance between the pain and the response to pain is where our work lies. At least, that's what Ben Sidran says. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. Every year around his birthday, my dad and I sit down for a conversation. It started when he turned 76, not so long ago. And with a few exceptions, we've done it ever since, capturing an ongoing record of where his head and heart are at that particular moment. Over the years, we've talked about music, memory, politics, travel, the craft of performing, and the art of living. These annual conversations have become a kind of time-lapse portrait. The same two people returning to the mic, always slightly changed. This year, as Ben turns 82, the theme that emerges is that he's still auditioning for the role of himself. We talk about what it means to keep creating, to stay curious, and to hold on to your sense of fun as the outside world speeds up and your own personal world contracts. He shares stories from his days hosting NPR's Jazz Alive and later Sidran on Record. He explains how he came to be the first person to record Billy Joel's New York State of Mind back in the 70s, even before Billy recorded it. He reflects on maintaining the outsider's perspective and weighs in on the latest curveball, AI-generated music. If you've been following this series of birthday talks, then this is a great addition to the canon. If this is your first one, welcome. You're dropping into the middle of a conversation that's been going on for years and that will, I hope, keep going for many more. Ben's most recent album, Are We There Yet? Live at the Sunside, was released earlier this summer.
That phone is ringing down an empty hall. Nobody answers, nobody called. Ghosts in the wires, begging for bread, machines with desires. Inside your head, is this the future? Is it the past? Is it the moment we arrive? At last, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there?
And he and I will be on tour in the Midwest later this summer.
Are we there yet?
We'll be in Chicago, Minneapolis, Madison, and Spring Green at Taliesin. Check out his website, bensidran.com, for all the details on those shows. Since we're talking about live dates, I'll share some of my own as well. I'll be doing two shows in Wisconsin with my own band this month, August 22nd in Madison and August 23rd in Milwaukee. I'll also be at Barbès in Brooklyn on September 17th, and then at the Café Central in Madrid, September 26th, 27th, and 28th. All of those dates and more are up on my website, leosidran.com. Visit my Substack for all the latest writing and episodes. It's leosidran.substack.com. And in fact, today I'm sharing the video from this episode. So if you want to see what we looked like on our Zoom while we were having this conversation, check it out on the Substack. Third-story.com is the place to visit the archive. Check out all the past episodes with Ben and hundreds of deep dives with other creative musicians and thinkers. And remember that we are made in partnership with WBGO Studios. Visit wbgo.org/studios for more of their award-winning content. Here's me and Ben Sidran talking it down. Hello.
Hello.
Okay. All right, here we are. We're doing it. This is what it is.
Okay. Yeah, this isn't bad.
I think this is our seventh or eighth one of these. I think we started when you were turning 75. You're turning 82 now.
Yes, I think you're right.
Pretty much every year around your birthday, we have one of these conversations. There was last year, I think we did not, because I had talked to you a couple of months earlier around the release of an album that you were putting out, Rainmaker, and then we talked a couple of months later after the presidential election, but we didn't get a proper birthday check-in.
Okay.
We're talking a day before your birthday here so I can get the episode together, and we're remote, which is unfortunate because we're going to be together for a few weeks starting next week, and it would be nice to do it together, but since I want it to come out for your birthday...
You're a stickler for these historical moments. I know this. I know that you want it on the birthday. You don't want it a week after the birthday. You don't want it before the birthday. I know that.
And what do you make of that?
Well, that's, you know, I never knew you to be such a meticulous student coming up. But in your middle years, you've become much more of a academic. That's kind of an academic point of view.
Yeah. And it's interesting because You are an academic, a kind of a recovering academic and so on.
Yes.
And you don't necessarily like to follow the rules.
Yeah.
You were a reluctant academic, I suppose, in some ways. But because I'm not really an academic, I think that it makes me a more serious person.
Yes.
To do these serious things, like follow strict rules of my own making, dates and deadlines.
Yeah, and I think that my whole intention was to undermine the academy. I was going to burrow into the academy and take it down from inside. I think that was going to be my role. I thought that was sort of what you did. You took the energy of the enemy and used it against it. That's where I was going.
Well, in some ways, I think that may be a way of looking at your whole life and career.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
There's a kind of an aspect of you that is just very anti-authority. You don't want to put anything in between you and the moment.
Well, that's true, but think about this. See, there's the moment, and then our reaction to the moment. The moment is the thing. That's the thing. The reaction to the moment is basically us auditioning for the role of being us. You know, we're trying out these different things. Because once we think about authenticity, it's impossible to be authentic, which is, you know, why meditation makes some people nervous, because they start to meditate and then they're afraid they can't meditate. And that makes them anxious because they think they can't meditate. And instead of just sitting there and not being able to meditate, they stop trying to meditate. And in that moment, give up the moment.
I mean, I'm going through this right now, right before. The reason I'm a few minutes late to this meeting is because I got hung up recording a vocal on a demo that I'm recording. And I got into my head about whether or not it sounds like me.
Yes.
Too much, not enough, or the right amount.
That's it. You're auditioning to be yourself. And you're judging yourself, even knowing that we can't hear ourselves. We proved that this week when I sent you a clip of me and Billy Peterson playing a duo probably 40 years ago. I bet it was 40 years ago. And it was swinging and it was burning and it was these two cats just having a ball. I kind of remember it as being, oh, just a gig, nothing one way or the other. But it was great. So there it was. I couldn't hear myself until later when I'm not trying to hear myself.
Right, and you sounded better than you ever remembered.
It was a foggy day in old Mad Town. Had me low, had me down. I viewed the future with such alarm, with such alarm. The old museum seemed to lose its charm. It had lost its charm then. How long, I wonder, could this thing last? But the age of miracles had not passed. 'Cause suddenly I saw you standing there, I saw you right there. And in foggy old Mad Town, the sun was shining, it was shining everywhere.
Well, that's when you sent me that tape of you and Billy playing 40 years ago, or whatever it was, 40, maybe more. And it's interesting because I could totally tell that it was you, and I could totally tell it was Billy, and yet you've each become more of yourself in a way, or it's kind of, it's developed. I wrote to you and I said, man, you're playing, it has changed over these years. That was very much you then, but you wouldn't play that way today.
No, this goes back to your thing of every one of these conversations is just being a snapshot in a rolling horizon, you know. Yeah. And while, as we know, it's not true that we become a different person every 7 years because ourselves replace themselves.
You sound like you've been reading my blog, by the way.
I'm reading your blog, man. I like your blog. I'd like to know more about this blogosphere thing. Am I blogging? Are we blogging now? This isn't a blog, right? This could be a blog.
It might be a blog. All right, let's slow down here.
Okay, you're right.
The first thing I want you to do is describe the situation in your house right now. Where are you Who else is in the house?
Oh.
What does it feel like?
Okay, good. I'm sitting in the music room in my house in Madison, Wisconsin. On one wall are hundreds of books all about music and blues and jazz and music theory. You know, even Harari's Sapiens is on the shelf. So it's a very eclectic shelf, but mostly music. And then directly across from me is a wall of about 4,000 LPs that I just look, you know, yesterday I pulled out a Clifford Jordan record, put it on. Great, fantastic.
So you've got these records in front of you. These are the records that you mostly collected in your college years when you worked at a record store, and then later on when you were a journalist and you had your show at NPR and these records would show up.
Right. That's what this wall is. Yeah.
And I'm glad that you're playing the records, because there was a time actually when you weren't playing the records.
Right. Right. And I'm glad too. I'm making a point to do that.
Yeah.
So next to the records is like a bookshelf with a lot of music in it, actually. And then to the other side of that is the piano. So that's the room I'm in. Oh, and my dog is right here with me, my poodle.
Yeah.
Rocky.
And the piano, this is the piano that you bought in what year?
It was before you were born.
Yeah.
So I would say I got it in 74. It's a Kawai. It was new in 1974.
Why'd you buy a Kawai piano?
Because the Kawai dealer sold it to me at cost if I did a television commercial for him. And then there are all these things on the wall here. There's a poster from the Montreux Festival, which I just love. It says, Pharoah Sanders, Mool Hall, Richard Abrams, the Brecker Brothers, and Ben Sidran.
Yeah.
That's a hell of a band right there. Then there's a poster from the Garcia Lorca gig, Patti Smith Group, Paco de Lucia Septet, and the Ben Sidran Quartet, another great band. And other stuff on the wall. So that's this room. And downstairs, there's a mahjong table set up where Judy and three of her co-conspirators are operating this ancient game of mahjong. To what end, I don't know. But they're down there and they meet regularly. There's something kind of spooky going on in mahjong. I can't put my finger on it. But they claim no. They claim no. It's just a game. But just before you called, I was playing piano. I was playing the old song Four. And I was doing it in what we used to call locked hand positions, you know, closed voicings like George Shearing.
Okay, so Judy's downstairs playing mahjong, which I think is, I don't know, symbolic of something. So that's what's going on in your world. That's like that you're kind of hiding out in this room with records and books and you're playing in your piano.
Yes.
Well, there's this like mahjong game going on downstairs. You're about to be 82.
Yes.
You know, which is like, that's a number. So what does that feel like? Does it feel the same as 75 and 45 and 25? Or, you know, does it feel different?
It does. It does. And the first thing that came to mind is that I'm kind of painting myself further into the corner. As you get older, the size of your world gets reduced. And I bet that's true even if you travel all the time. I was thinking this the other day. I was watching, I don't know what it was, the kids across the street on their skateboard ramp or whatever it is. And I was thinking about everything is so open-ended for them. Whereas for me, everything closes in. And I think that's age. I think age is a gradual closing in.
You go back and forth constantly between whether or not you want to do another thing or not.
If you
have an idea or not. I see you still, as soon as you have an idea, you start to just force of habit or some kind of animal instinct, I don't know what, like start making it happen. And then I've seen it in the last couple of years, you know, you do that and then at some point you go, I was wrong. I take it back. I don't want that. And then another one happens. But I think it is that reaction to, is my world contracting or not? Do I want it to contract or not?
Yes. Well, it's always been the goal, you know, how do I feel positive and useful and creative if I'm not generating artifacts? That's been right. My case.
Yes. And you've left a massive trail. I mean, a trail that is just so much stuff, and it would take a lifetime for somebody to go through and listen to it and make sense of it all. And but since you've accumulated all that stuff and made all that stuff and captured all this history and wrote your books and all this stuff, you don't have that as a requirement anymore.
Right. Isn't that amazing? 40 albums, another 60 albums out there with other people, books, lecture, all this nonsense. And there's not necessarily peace. It just makes no sense at all. I'm still auditioning.
Yeah, I get that. And, you know, God, there's so many times in a given day or week when I am reminded of your life. Like last week, I watched the Billy Joel documentary, which is just so great. And you and I were texting about it. And man, I'm curious to know what you thought about it. But as I said to you, one of my takeaways was I really do feel that there might be a direct correlation between the amount of pain that somebody goes through and their artistry. And I hate to say that because I'm not in so much pain.
It made you question your artistry.
Exactly. I love knowing that you have this little, what is it, a sidebar.
Yeah.
In the Billy Joel story, when he tells the story of writing New York State of Mind, because, you know, you've always told the story of how you came to be associated with that song, or you had a little piece of the story. And he corroborated it in a way in the movie that he was trying to write a song for Sinatra to sing.
Yeah, right. And that's the story that I heard. I don't think of it as my brush with fame so much as a pretty accurate summation of my relationship to the business, which is right in the center and at the farthest removal at the same time.
Well, sometimes when you're standing right in the center of something,
yes,
you become invisible.
Yes, the eye of the hurricane, man. Nothing's going on. Yeah, so the story, very briefly, is in, I think, 1974, 75. I'm in Los Angeles. I'm in the office of a friend of mine who is the publisher of Irving Almo Music.
Who was it?
Michael Jackson, obviously. Not the moonwalking guy, but another guy. And he worked with Paul Williams, who wrote We've Only Just Begun. I mean, that was what a hit sounded like then. And I walked in there, I was hanging out with him, and I've never told anybody this. He threw two pieces of music across the desk at me. The first piece, forgive me, was a song called It's So Hard to Say I Love You When You're Sitting on My Face.
It's so hard to say I love you when you're sitting on my face.
And then the second piece he sent across the desk to me was a song called New York State of Mind. And he said, this guy, Billy Joel, wrote this thing. And he wrote it for Sinatra, and Sinatra didn't do it. And we're not sure what to do. Maybe you'd like to record it. Because the first time a song is recorded, that's controlled by the publisher. After that, anybody can record it. So I looked at it, and I liked it. I liked the idea and the chords. And so I took the sheet music home with me, and a few months later, I recorded it. And I recorded it like a New York nightclub song. I had Richard T. play organ. Woody Shaw play this haunted Art Blakey in the Jazz Messenger style trumpet solo on. I mean, I went all the way into the basement. So the record came out.
And it was easy living day by day.
And it was getting airplay in New York on WRVR.
so far away from the rhythm and blues.
And the word came back to me that Billy Joel was a little put out.
But now I need some give and take.
That some nobody named Ben Sidran recorded the song
New York Times, I'll take.
Instead of Frank Sinatra.
The Daily News.
So my brush with celebrityhood here was I was playing at the bitter end.
I'll get on down to reality. That's just fine with me because I have let it slide.
And sitting on the table right in front of me is Billy Joel.
And I don't care if it's Chinatown.
And his then wife, I guess her name was Elizabeth.
No, no, no. I got no expectations, Lord. I have left them all behind.
They were clearly coming to hear me sing New York State of Mind. The first person to record it. And the person whom a lot of people at the time thought wrote it, because I was the only person who had recorded it.
New York, New York.
And so perversely, I didn't play the song until the very end of the third set, because we had to do three sets at the time then. And by then, he and his wife had been drinking and were really a little overserved and had, I think, maybe forgotten why they had come. And there was a scene in front of me at this table. And I did. I sang the song to him, which I remember got his attention. But by then, it was the train had left the station. And I never got to ask him if he liked my version. But I think that was beside the point.
Yes, I've seen all the movie stars with their fancy cars and their limousines. And I've been high up in the mountains, down under the evergreens. Ah, but now I know what I'm needing. I don't want to waste, I ain't gonna waste my time. In a New York state of mind. New York, New York. City so nice they had to name it twice.
That's my brush with New York State of Mind, and I still am the first person ever to record that song.
So, you know, I've heard you tell that story over the years, and I often wonder, what does it say about you?
Yeah.
That you refused to play it until the end of the night, that you made him sit there. Like, it's a response to something. I'm not sure what it is. It's not all negative, but it's definitely a thing.
Don't you think it's connected to what we were talking about before, auditioning to be yourself?
I do think it has something to do with being anti-authoritarian in some way.
Yes, anti-authoritarian. Oh, see, I like that. You see me. You know what? I think you're probably right. I was talking to somebody about the book, There Was a Fire, on Jews in American popular culture and popular music. Who was it was interviewing me recently about it? Anyway, it just lit up in front of me like a neon sign. That book is about me. That book is about me. Wait a minute. I mean, I thought when I wrote it, it was something entirely different. But talking about it, it's all search for self, man. It's all search for self. You're trying to project, because you can't talk about yourself. You can't hear yourself. You can't see yourself.
Well, it is true. I thought about this. The only person in the world who can't see you is you.
Yeah. Well, that's true. And same thing for all of us, right? The only way we see ourselves is in a mirror, and we're backwards. We can never see ourselves as we are, ever.
You never will.
Never will.
So that is what it is. It really is the search for self in the most basic way. That
basic. And maybe that's it, man. Maybe that's it. You know, we're all living with PTSD now, the post-Trump. Oh, I know, this was funny. So I'm reading a book about the evolution of Greenwich Village. It's a nice book. But in it, Woody Guthrie's daughter tells a story. They were living in the village, and there's a knock on the door. Their landlord was Fred Drumpf.
Oh, before he changed the name.
Before he changed the name. Fred Drumpf was knocking on the door, demanding his rent. And she referred to the fact that her father, Woody, wrote this song about the landlord, which was about Fred Drumpf being the most evil person. And when he dies, he should go to hell. And that was 60 years before Fred Drumpf's son, Donald Drumpf, became the scourge of all of us. So who says musicians are not the canary in the coal mine?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well, that has come up even with your own songs in my life over and over again. And I think I've said this to you before. You know, you've got these lines, these expressions that you say sometimes that I'm so tired of hearing because I heard them my whole life. I think they don't mean anything. And then every now and then I'm like, oh, shit, it really did mean a thing. He said a thing. Like, you got this line in Down on the Dorsey Side. Blue Camus. What's that tune called?
Blue Camus.
You say, you'll never do tomorrow what you won't do today.
That's right. You'll never do tomorrow what you won't do today.
You spend your life looking for the way. You never do tomorrow what you won't do today. Enough is never enough when time is slip-sliding away. Je vous parvoir, je vous pas sentir. It's all so dark, but it's all so clear. To the other guy, you're the other guy.
And actually, when I wrote that line, I didn't know what it meant.
To the stranger, you're the stranger.
I know what it means now, man.
I do too. Isn't that great? Can you imagine what goes through Dylan's mind, all that crazy stuff he wrote? He didn't know what any of it meant, and now he probably does. What a world he lives in.
Or he doesn't. You know, I mean, in this is what I felt with the Billy Joel. I'm sure it happens to Dylan, too. I mean, Dylan, I think, maintains that he can't do what he did before. He can't go back there. He doesn't know where it came from or what it was.
Right.
And Billy Joel, I mean, we've seen this, and we've got friends and people that we've worked with for whom the same is true. People who are a flood and have this open channel for years and years and years,
yeah,
and then it just closes.
Yeah.
And it dries up.
It does.
I mean, and for Billy Joel to say,
yeah,
I'm kind of done. I don't want to do this anymore. And I'm tired of the tyranny of the rhyme. He said, I like that.
Yes. Yes.
But you're not done. You're slower. Mm-hmm. And clearly slows down. Something happens where
mm-hmm.
doesn't happen as quickly, but it's not done for you. But I'm just always curious about that. How does that happen to people that they have it and
well,
then they don't have it anymore?
Well, it's because as you age, you just don't have the vitality that you used to have, and that transfers to the spirit as well as to the body. But alternatively, the reason I keep dipping my toe back into the pool is because it's so much fun. I mean, that's literally the whole of it. It's fun. It's fun hanging out with you. I love hanging out and talking to you and playing music and hanging out with musicians and traveling around and goofing. The hang, it's always been about that for me. And that's why when people get super serious about jazz, especially, you know, academic, here we go back to the academics, but when people get super serious about it, and there's reason to be super serious because it's brilliant, but you gotta have fun to play music that makes other people feel good. People don't feel good when they see how smart you are. People yeah. feel good when they see that you're able to enjoy yourself. And one of the reasons we're living in this cosmic hell these days is because these guys project nothing but anger, anger, anger. There's no fun. I mean, there's no dignity also, but there's nothing but darkness and noise and background noise. And so that just drives me further into my corner of where's the fun?
That was your answer to the question, why does the faucet turn off for some people? But I liked it because, as you said, the body is slower, it's more exhausting, and so it affects your spirit. Like, the reason we're doing this interview today is because I just was like, we've got to do this. It's our annual thing. We have to do this, and so there has to be desire. There has to be that spark of desire. Do you think that's why people have a hard time writing as they get older? Or they have a hard time finishing things?
I think that's exactly it, the desire. Well, that's my Phil Woods anecdote where I asked Phil Woods, what's it like to be able to play anything you can hear? Because, my God, he could. He said, oh, playing's no problem. He said, the problem is wanting to play. He said, you wake up in the morning and you have to convince yourself that you want to play that melody. And I thought, wow, it's the desire for desire. The desire itself, you're chasing the tail of an ephemeral thing. It's really pretty cosmic when you think about it. You need, you want when you're young, you desire. And as you gradually become a little calcified or whatever, it's at a remove. And so, again, you have to be able to laugh, man. You have to be able to laugh at yourself. It's the only way you survive, man. The only way we can survive out here, and jazz musicians certainly have known this, as have the Jews, is laugh at yourself.
Yeah.
Laugh at yourself, laugh with yourself, find the humor in your situation, because somewhere in there, that's your authentic self.
As you talk about this idea of having an outsider's perspective, like I think you have the position of the outsider as the jazz musician, as the Jew, as the, as you described earlier, the sort of mole in the system in academia. Yeah. I think part of what maybe has kept you from joining the mainstream, whatever that is that once you become the guy in charge, you can no longer maintain the outsider's position or perspective. And that one of your major motivators was to sort of stay on the outside. I mean, can you witness something if you're within it, or do you have to maintain a certain amount of remove? Because your biggest job, you claimed for the longest time, was to be a witness to history. You referred to your own music as a form of journalism for a time.
I'm raising my right hand and saying amen, man. That's exactly right. That's how I look at it. Something very attractive to me in being that guy.
When you talked to Phil Woods and he told you that story about Desire for Desire, I imagine that was during one of your interviews that you did, because you interviewed all these cats, you know, in a variety of different circumstances, but most of them were for what was originally an NPR radio show that you had.
Right.
The reason I say this is because you were really there as NPR was kind of coming on.
Yeah.
And we're watching it essentially not become dismantled, because their funding is actually not so contingent on government funding. But basically, NPR has become a, what do they call it? A
whipping boy.
Whipping boy. It's become something to point the MAGA laser at. Just tell me about early NPR and, like, tell me how you showed up in that space.
It was a great time because, first of all, in the 70s, really, late 60s, early 70s, along came FM radio and stereo radio and freeform radio. So you would go to any major city and you could hear Aretha Franklin played right next to John Coltrane, played right next to Paul Butterfield or something. It was wide open. And then NPR, which I think started in the mid 70s, not only was it intellectually rigorous and have a local component, but also a national component with All Things Considered and the news services, it really loomed large in a time of Nixon and Ford and that whole Vietnam controversy. It was right there at the center of it. And at the time, rock and roll was really taken off. When I say rock and roll, that includes disco and all of the output of the record industry. Jazz was pretty much in the doldrums. Blue Note had stopped making new records. The clubs had turned into, like, clubs where jazz musicians played, they all hired blues musicians and rock musicians at the same time. And jazz was kind of shipped into dry dock. And it was played on NPR. And there was a show on NPR called Jazz Alive that was hosted by Billy Taylor, the wonderful piano player, raconteur. And Jazz Alive was a national program. It was carried on 280 stations across the United States. Now, the good news is that a station in Poughkeepsie could record a local group, and if they were good enough, they'd send the tape to Washington, D.C., and Jazz Alive would put the tape on the air, and that local person had national exposure. That was the good news. The bad news is that NPR had made a deal with the performing rights agencies, ASCAP and BMI, and they didn't pay royalties. They were exempt from having to pay songwriters royalties. So wherever you heard jazz, you knew that the guys weren't getting paid, which, of course, made everybody feel comfortable again, because we know that world.
We're accustomed to not getting paid.
Yes, we long for those days, the good old days. So in any case, Billy Taylor left the show and they were looking for a new host for Jazz Alive. They had a bunch of people rotating through the show. I went on the show. They liked me hanging out. They gave me the job. I became the host of Jazz Alive. So for three or four years, I commuted to Washington, D.C. and sat in an office with piles and stacks of quarter-inch tape around me, auditioning all these things that had come in from around the country and putting them on the air and interviewing people and talking about people. And four times a year, like New Year's Eve, we'd do a New Year's Eve live broadcast across the four time zones from New York to Chicago to Denver to L.A. And one year I was in New York hosting it with the Brecker Brothers, and Billy Taylor was in Chicago with Chico Freeman, etc. I mean, this was the jazz royalty. If you could get on NPR, that was jazz royalty, and that's what it was. And then, of course, NPR got into financial trouble, I think about 1983, 84. Frank Mankiewicz, who used to, I think, work for Kennedy, had taken over NPR by then and somehow misplaced $5 million. He couldn't remember where he put it, and that took down NPR. And the first thing they threw overboard was the cultural stuff. So All Things Considered survived, but the jazz and all that went south. And so what I did was I started talking to jazz musicians on my own and making a program out of it and selling it back to NPR. So they're going out.
That's the mistake I made. I forgot to sell my show to anybody.
Well, you know, that is a mistake, and I'm sorry you had to learn it, but I hope you have learned it. And I hope there's an act two for this, that you too can find a revenue stream.
Okay, so you sold it back to NPR and you talked to all these people.
And I talked to these musicians, and I did it for 5 years. The only thing that pays less in this marketplace than being a jazz musician is National Public Radio. And I was a jazz musician on National Public Radio. So it was a very righteous position.
Yeah.
And to make it even more righteous, when I called somebody up to be a guest on the show, I would pay them $75 for a cab fare. You know, we didn't have Zoom. The interviews were all done at a recording studio on Broadway. But I would pay everybody I paid Horace Silver $75. I paid Miles Davis $75 to do the interview. So, I mean, it was straight up righteous. This is a jazz thing, and we're going to talk about you, and we're going to talk about your life, and we're going to talk about what it feels like trying to get paid at night, and we're going to not put you on a pedestal and ooh and aha about jazz, how out it is and how weird it is. My whole thing was I want to demystify this music. I want people to understand that jazz musicians are just like they are, only more so. That was my line. You know, and it worked. The only problem is the fly in the ointment was, as I say, there was no money at all in it. And I had to finance this flying around recording business. So I cobbled together a little underwriting. But every year, you know, it was like being a politician. Politicians spend most of their time raising money to be a politician, not being a politician.
Yep.
I was having to spend most of my time trying to raise money to be on the air, to try to raise money. And after 5 years, I stopped. But the show worked great. People liked it. And the thing that was so interesting is at the time, NPR assumed that their listeners were urban, were older, were white, lived on the East Coast or the West Coast, right? They had a profile. And I started getting a lot of mail. I mean, my show, I think, was on a couple hundred stations. I was getting a lot of mail. And it was clear that the jazz listener was everybody, young, old, urban, country, in prison, chairman of the corporation. The jazz audience is potentially everybody. The music appeals to who it appeals to, not for old-fashioned demographic reasons, but for something deeper, you know, some personal connection to, like you were saying, the ratio of pain to creativity is somewhere buried deep within the jazz life. And people respond to that.
How would you prepare for those interviews? You did a lot of them in a short amount of time.
Yeah.
And you fitted in around a lot of other stuff. What would you do to get ready? Did you have a kind of a depth of familiarity with everybody that you talked to before you talked to them? Were there some people that you talked to that you sort of had to catch up and cram for or think about? Like, just what was your process like?
Well, I started out preparing. The first guest on my radio show was Sanborn. So I mean, I didn't have to prepare too hard. I knew his career. I knew his sound. I knew where he came from. We were the same age, approximately. But I very quickly saw that it really was just about people talking, that knowing a lot is probably knowing too much. And that what you're doing when you're doing an interview or a conversation is you're taking the place of the listener at home. The listener doesn't necessarily know anything. So you don't have to know that much. What you have to do is listen. So that's what I did. I listened to the music. That's what I listened to. I listened to them. And I was familiar. I mean, I was just a complete jazz record store rat, you know. I mean, I knew all the records. And I was in love with pretty much everybody I got to talk to because they could speak this language, man. And to this day, I'm just so knocked out by people who can speak this language. It's such a great language, and it's not that easy. So it wasn't that I was a fan of the hipster aspect of it. I was just super impressed by the jazz life and the process and how these people were changed as people by the business and the music, and I just wanted to talk to him about that. So that's how I went in. I mean, I remember particularly the afternoon Gil Evans came in, and it's true, we did 2, 3, 4 interviews in a day. I mean, I'd sit in a studio, and here would come Blakey and Gil Evans and Sonny Rollins and whoever, and we'd just sit and talk.
And would you have to kind of reset yourself a little bit before the next person came in, or you just wrote it?
It was pretty wild. I had an engineer who went with me through the whole process. He was a recording ninja, and whatever was there, he was recording it, and that's what he did all day long. And the two of us sat there, and we heard all this stuff go down, and I just did my best, man. I don't know what I was doing. That was the thing. I had done NPR radio before, and I used to, after I was done doing the Jazz Alive show, I would go into the news bureau and watch them do the nightly news, the All Things Considered, and see how good they were, how smooth they were, how they talked like real people. And when they did interviews, there was something very intimate about them. You know, it's the same thing that Saturday Night Live keeps spoofing about NPR. But the fact is, they had this really good technique. And when I would ask newscasters, how do you do what you do? I mean, how can I learn here? There was no secret. It's the same thing about jazz. Listen, just listen. Listen, that's the whole thing.
Yeah, the information is in it, is in the material.
The information's in the material. Isn't that what you said about the music?
The songs tell you what you need.
Yeah, the songs tell you. I love it.
So part of the picture that gets painted when you describe doing the show also is like how spread out the country was. The idea that you would be on 200 stations, that a band from Poughkeepsie could get national attention. You know, we really have to readjust our vision of what the world was like. Yeah. That there just was no way to get heard if you didn't get put on the radio or you didn't go out and drive across the country and try to play in these places. And that, you know, all of these interviews that you did required physically moving yourself around and the kind of logistics and coordination around it. And it's interesting, you know, when I think about what you describe on every level about what jazz is or was, the demographic of who listened to the music, also that not only did you not need to prepare too much for the interviews other than listening to the music and listening to what they had to say, but there almost was no way to prepare. You know, when I prepare for the interviews that I do, I kind of have to stop myself from preparing in the sense that everybody I'm talking to has a website. They probably have a Wikipedia page. There's probably some published interview. There's some YouTube of them. Even the people who aren't known at all have kind of put their own assets in place.
Maybe especially those people.
And so I have to kind of like decide how much I want to go into it. And in fact, and this speaks to this idea of the blogosphere today and, you know, the academy versus the blogosphere. Everybody's an expert. Everybody's got an opinion and a right to share it, and everybody puts it out there. And I can sense that there was a kind of a liberation in being one of the few people who was helping to tell these people's stories because there was no concern about knowing everything or not. It was just you were the person that was out there doing this, mm-hmm. You know, and what you describe is, I think, of a much more innocent time just in general.
Well, it was totally because, and it was a more innocent time in that there were very few books written about jazz. There were very few people talking about jazz. Thelonious Monk's phone number was in the New York phone book. And the fact that I was participating in giving musicians access to their audience, and I loved that. And you know the story. At one point, I had 110 interviews stored at a NPR station's vault, and they wanted more space for their shelves for other tapes, and they were going to throw these tapes away. Even some people at NPR didn't realize that a conversation with Miles Davis wasn't about them or their shelves, it was about history. And so I really felt like one of the people, like the guy I worked for, his name is Tim Owens, you probably remember Tim Owens, he was the producer of Jazz Alive. And he and I, and a few other people who went on into the jazz radio business, you know, they went to BGO or they went to wherever, there were a handful of people. And I would have to say from the point of musicians, there were a couple of handfuls of musicians. Everybody wasn't being a musician.
It wasn't the cliche that it is today that on your block,
yeah,
there's at least one person whose niece, nephew, cousin, yeah, or own child is trying to be a jazz musician today.
There it is. Boy, is that true. That is, and I bet that's 100% true. I bet that's accurate. No, it was completely underground. And I keep saying this because it seems like such a feature of the times, but it was so much quieter then. And I don't just mean quieter. There was no horrible 24/7 internet radiation in everybody's life, but even on the streets, even in the cities, it was quieter and you could hear yourself think, and thinking was important. Now thinking is sort of like a defensive mechanism. Back then, it was part of the search.
When you talk about this idea of a Miles Davis interview being about history and about legacy rather than about shelf space or, you know, yeah, whatever the factors of the moment are, you know, I ask myself this question all the time. I am also following in the footsteps of, I really believe part of my job is to just document the world as I see it and my life as I see it. And I've come to understand that that is part of the job. That's a big part of what I'm doing. But it's less and less clear today what is important from a historical point of view, in part because history is moving so quickly. The journalists are doing their best,
yes,
to capture this waterfall in their little buckets, but it's just impossible to get any space to even decide, is this important? How is this important? And maybe that's what's happening in the music too.
I think it's happening globally. I don't think the music's separate at all from, you know, climate change. I really think it's literally the same conversation. And you're right, it's more crowded. Remember back in the day, people, the Malthusians, were terrified that we were going to outpopulate our ability to produce food for the world's population. It turns out that's not the case. We can provide all the food, except the people are killing each other slowly. Ultimately, we have the upper hand, and I'll tell you why. Because history, despite people's best efforts, is not about policy. It's not about ideas. It's not about morality, sadly. It's not weighted to a sense of the good. History is what we make of it and what we live every day. That's as true a definition of what history is as any definition. And so it's not the fact that we're feeling pain all the time because of what's happening, because we are feeling pain and you can't deny it. I mean, we're traumatized, man. Something terrible is happening and I don't deny it. But the response to pain is something separate than the pain itself. And in that distance between the pain and the response to pain is where our work is. And when you're doing your work, you're working in that area. And that's where you work on yourself. You know, my thought that when you play an instrument, you're really working on yourself. The instrument doesn't change. You could play it for 50 years. It's going to stay the same, but you will be totally transformed. I think that's the same thing with the work you're doing. And I think that when I say that your ability to listen and desire to tell stories is a form of prayer, I don't mean to overweight the situation.
You said to me last year when I asked you, what am I doing? Why am I having these conversations? Is it promotion? Is it journalism? You said it's prayer. Your project of interviewing people is a form of prayer.
And I think that's what we're doing out here. I think that's where this whole religion conspiracy came from. I mean, these are old, old questions. So there's a way that we operate within the human experience, and the vocabulary falls apart here, obviously, that is not identical to what's happening to us. Mm. What's happening to us literally is part of the problem. How we live with it is a bigger part of the problem. And by doing what you're doing, you are not just accommodating the problem, but in your own way, you're correcting the problem. I mean, it's like climate change. Climate change is every bus out there that's spewing methane. That's climate change. So healing the place where we are is every one of us. That is climate change, human climate change.
You know, you used to say that a big part of what was interesting you was the relationship between technology and art. And you saw, again, in a way that feels much more innocent, how recording technology changed the music. The space between 1940 and 1980,
wow,
whatever that, you know, that 40 years,
yep,
is the same space between 1980 and 2020. And think about how much happened between 1940 and 1980, how long that felt.
That's true.
And the technology that came and completely transformed.
Yes.
What happened to the music? And that was that area that you were thinking about, multi-track recording and headphones and, you know, and the record business, all that stuff that had come forward in those 40 or 60 years.
Yeah. Well, there were physical changes. You could see them.
Yeah.
They were not virtual changes.
But actually in the last, forget 40 years, 10 years, it's like so many things have tipped beyond our ability, human ability, to recover or protect ourselves against. Like, they are of our own making, but we don't know how to defend against. These are both extremely human problems and also problems that are well beyond the ability of humans to solve.
Oh, we're way past our pay grade, man. We have no business out in these areas that we're in. That's a fact. And I don't suppose you would know that or feel that if you didn't have some experience, which is maybe where age comes in and acts as a kind of buffer to the passing of time, not because of any moral position, because God knows on this planet there are an infinite number of moral positions that should be taken, that this is not okay what's going on here. But that's not the reason. That has its own justification. That's a closed circle in a way. I'm talking more about this phenomenon that is, I think, well summed up by the image of working on an instrument, where you work on it and you work on it and eventually you change. You're transformed. I think this is what people like Leonard Cohen attempted to do by going into an ashram. Yeah. And spending 5 years in a cave. I think this is the same attempt. How do we transform ourselves? What do I need to continue this particular project that I started?
Project of you, the project of your life.
I'm auditioning. You're right. I'm still, I love it. Hey, let me ask you something. Have we said anything in the last hour?
Well, it remains to be seen. I think that the idea that you are still auditioning is probably the one that will stand out as the message here. Turning 82 years old, I'm still auditioning for the role of myself. I don't think you could top that. I want to tell you this thing that happened to me yesterday. 10 years ago, I wrote a song with somebody. It was a kind of a nasty, funky tune, and we put it out, but in a kind of an indie way. And anyway, I got a text message yesterday from that same person, and there's a version he sent me. Big band arrangement, strings, a kind of a crooner singing it, but with these strings and horns and rhythm section and a swing take on it. And I tell you, man, wasn't bad.
Oh, really?
It was generic. It was pretty stock.
So what's your takeaway?
So then 5 minutes later, the same cat sends me another tune that we wrote 10 years ago. This time we had recorded it as a kind of a pop indie tune, live drums, live guitars on the original. And this version that he sends me sounds kind of like Swedish pop production, a female singer, pop singer, good synthesizer programming, great mix.
Hmm.
And I said, who's producing? So, I know he's got a publishing deal. I said, who's doing this? Is your publisher cutting new demos on our tunes? And he said, I'm doing all this production. And knowing who this was, I said, this is AI. And he said, the world just changed, man. The music business is changed.
Wow.
Basically, he's playing our recordings into this app and prompting it. I want it like this, and I want it like that. I want it like this. And I don't know if he's got to tell it the lyrics or if it's transcribing the lyrics. And it is making credible, if slightly unoriginal, but highly produced, believable recordings.
Whoa.
So this isn't writing songs, it's producing tracks. There are some people that look at this technology and say, we need to learn how to work with it and not work against it. And this is the future, and we can't deny it or ignore it. We can't defend against it. It is a reality. I mean, as he said, record making has just become democratized because it's just prompting. I'm extremely afraid of this because the market is about to get totally flooded in a way that I think the whole idea of what a song is, what a record is, what any of that is just completely made irrelevant. And, you know, the only reason to listen to a record that was made by a real person, played by real people, is because you choose to, because it matters to you. But from the point of view of a consumer who's listening to music and doesn't really care about that, there's no difference. But it did give me the sense that, okay, there's no reason for me to ever make anything ever again to sound competitive with what's on the radio or what's professional or what's commercial, because that's what the AI can do. The only thing the AI can't do
is what you and I are doing right here,
is be me.
That's right. That's what AI can't do. That's why what you're doing remains free and important, because it's not being made into sausage, because it reflects life on planet Earth at a particular time.
I mean, AI might do that too in its way. It just won't do it in the way that I'll do it. And I don't know that it matters. I can't even, you know.
Totally matters. Totally matters.
This is the question I'm asking myself. And this is why when I set this up, I said, we have created these problems of technology that are greater than our ability to stop them or defend ourselves from them.
Right. Right. Right.
The aliens haven't attacked us.
We are the aliens.
We are the aliens, and we've attacked ourselves.
Yes. How about that? How about that? We've met the enemy, and it is us.
It is us. So, yes. You know, I guess I pose that for you, question for you as well. Like, you know, there are so many conditions that have changed in your lifetime.
Yeah. Well, and yet it remains the same condition. I mean, it's sort of a cliche, but it's been the same question from beginning to end. I don't feel it's any different now. I feel it's much faster, harder, bigger, whatever. I mean, the size of it, you know, as the universe continues to expand, the issue becomes greater. But, you know, what we're talking about is as classic as life 5,000 years ago. This is the same conversation, man.
You know, some years we talk about the physical aspects of getting older. Sometimes it's the philosophical questions. Sometimes it's logistics. Sometimes we talk about the tour. For example, this month you'll be in Madison, Chicago, Minneapolis, and Spring Green, Wisconsin playing gigs.
Spring Green would be a great gig.
But this year, I guess the final question for you is, when will you, after so many years of auditioning for the role of yourself, when will you know if you got the gig?
That is the question. When will I know that I got the gig? Oh, man. If I knew that, I wouldn't have to ask any more questions. If I knew the answer to that one question. That's a great question, isn't it?
May you never get the gig.
May you never get the gig. May your dreams never come true.
Happy birthday, Ben.
Leo, what a pleasure, man. What a great pleasure. This is not only the reason to get up in the morning, it's a reason to go to bed at night.
Ah, and to dream.
And to dream.
There he was, my friends, Ben Sidran, still auditioning. May he never get the gig. After we talked, I asked him to send me a recording of him at the piano playing the Miles Davis song 4, the one that he mentioned he had been practicing. And that's what you hear behind me. Come see us on the road this month in the Midwest or visit bensidran.com to keep an eye on future performances. I'll be back again in your headspace before you know it with another deep dive. Until then, I'll talk to you soon.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.